This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
Anthony, for those of you who can't see you, I'm going to tell the world that you're a super fit guy.
Well,
in pretty good shape.
I appreciate that, Meghna.
So I'm going to actually also guess that your cholesterol levels are pretty good?
Last time I checked, I'm doing okay.
Okay, so not taking Lipitor.
Nothing like that. Not any statins for that matter. And I think I can thank some good genes for this.
Good. Well, actually, that would put you in probably an ever-decreasing number of Americans. Since I just looked this up today, Lipitor still is the number one selling prescription drug in the world. Its 2010 sales alone topped $10 billion. So really good news for its maker, Pfizer.
And that's a definition of a blockbuster drug. But there is bad news for the drug giant, too, because Pfizer's patent on Lipitor expires next month.
That's right, June 2011. Although we're not going to see a generic version of Lipitor in the United States until about November.
But still, losing patent protection on one of the biggest blockbuster drugs of all time is a big setback for Pfizer.
But it's also actually a really good opportunity for a new breed of drug developer that happens to be making its presence known right here in Massachusetts. Now, Kurt Nickisch, WBUR's business and technology reporter, had a good story about this exact issue today on Morning Edition. He's with us now. Hi there, Kurt.
Hey, yeah.
So there's so much from your story that really stuck with us, and we want to go a lot deeper into this. But let me just start by asking you, featured one particular new Massachusetts company, and the name of that company is?
Lipimedics.
Lipimedics. So very clear about exactly what market they're going after.
Yeah, except that they actually isn't a they. It's actually one guy, Dennis Goldberg. He is developing a cholesterol drug. It's sort of an improvement. It addresses people for whose genes Lipitor doesn't work for. And he basically has his corner office in the corner of his living room, looking out over a flooded cranberry bog, watching great blue herons land and walk around. And that's where he gets his drug development work done.
He's running a drug company out of his house.
Out of his house, yeah. Eventually, he'll have some advisors over. They sit around the coffee table and discuss certain things and what they have to file with the FDA and so on. But basically, he's doing it all there. And here's what he says about why he decided not to build a proper company to do this.
You know, do we really need to build another big company? This industry, there are plenty of pharma companies. There are 4,500 biotech companies. We need more drugs. So we're just focusing on the drug part. Normally, you get this into a big company and you get all the bells and whistles and you're spending all the stuff on overhead, you can spend easily 60, 80 million.
So 60, 80 million, he said. So, Kurt, that's a lot of money to get a drug through the early and unpredictable phases of development. How much cheaper is he doing it for?
And what exactly does he mean, by the way, by we're just focusing on the drug part?
Just developing the drug, not hiring people and having, you know, a few vice presidents and have labs and hire researchers and have a public relations staff and all that sort of stuff. He's doing it with his and investor money for $6 million.
So one-tenth?
One-tenth of what you'd have to do. And part of the reason it's so much more expensive to have that overhead is because you're taking a drug through many different steps of a process. So at one point in the process, you need a lab to do one thing, but then you need different expertise for sort of the next stage in the process, and it's not necessarily the same people for each step of the way. So keeping everybody completely busy all the time is almost impossible, even at big drug companies where they have many drugs to be working on at one time.
And he avoids this by not having all those people under one roof?
Yeah, so he basically has the roof somewhere else, and he contracts all of this out. So he has he basically has labs in the Boston area that are doing research for him. He has a peptide manufacturer that's actually making the drug. And I went to one of these places where they are actually doing research for hundreds of experiments at one point. I was in this giant warehouse, which was this whole building full of plastic bubbles. And these workers are sitting in there sort of tending to these mice in these plastic isolation chambers.
This is what we're hearing now, right?
This is what we're hearing now.
Mice in plastic bubbles.
And the CEO of Charles River Laboratories in Wilmington, he said that, you know, he is basically providing the overhead for these virtual companies.
And they're basically renting a bubble or a whole row of bubbles, or we hope a whole building of bubbles. But they don't have to own the bubbles themselves. They don't have to own the building, and they don't have to employ the employees. We do that for them.
Another smaller contract research lab is Glyco Solutions in Worcester. Elizabeth Higgins was pleasantly surprised to see how one of these one-person drug company CEOs paid her staff.
Then we received the check in the mail, personal check from his Charles Schwab account. He's paying for it out of his own money.
So, Kurt, that was from your piece this morning, and the reason why I wanted to replay it is because it raised a question in my mind. I mean, when you hear it described like that, it almost sounds... This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
We are talking about a new model for the development of pharmaceutical drugs, and it's a model that's taking off right here in Massachusetts' very dynamic biotech sector. WBUR's business and technology reporter Kurt Nikisch had a story this morning. We're talking about it more, and he is with us today. Hi there, Kurt.
Hiya.
Also joining us now is Boston Globe's innovation columnist, Scott Kersner. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Scott.
Good to be here.
And with us is Michael Gilman. He is founder and CEO of Stromedics, a venture capital-backed biotech company based in Cambridge. Before that, he was executive vice president for research at Biogen Idec, another very big name in the biotech world here in the Boston area. Michael Gilman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And listeners, you know, we were talking about before the break this new model that Kurt walked us through about one person or maybe a few people and one drug, and that is a new chapter in drug development here. What do you make of it? Does this idea of maybe, if I could call it, boutique drug companies or venture capital-backed small biotech mean something new for how drugs are researched and developed in Massachusetts and around the world? And the story of small pharma is one of specializing and outsourcing, as Kurt mentioned, and that's one that's opposed to diversification or doing everything sort of in-house under one roof. Does that story sound familiar to you? And is this a good thing when it comes to capital-intensive and time-intensive world of drug development? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm especially interested from hearing anyone in this world out there who's listening today to Radio Boston. So, Michael Gilman, let me start with you. First of all, why did you leave Biogen? I mean, that's a very successful, good company. You were an executive VP there. What were they not giving you that running a eight-person company now allows you to do?
Well, the truth is, I was a bureaucrat, and being a bureaucrat wasn't making me very happy. I discovered, particularly since I've gone to Stromedics, and we're six people, actually, I'm actually happier when I'm closer to the real work. So, you know, it's not really a reflection on Biogen Idec per se. It's just kind of works better for me.
Okay, so it works better for you. You're closer to the work. And so what you're working on developing a particular drug for fibrosis,
Yeah, fibrosis. It's basically wound repair gone bad, and it's a consequence of chronic cycles of tissue injury and repair that over the course of years basically leads to the accumulation of scar tissue in your organs. So a diabetic, for example, who suffers from kidney disease, that's fibrosis, or somebody who has a hepatitis C infection in their liver. Big problem, and that's what we're interested in.
You know, Kurt, before the break, and in his piece, he mentioned that one of the things that the smaller sort of virtual companies, is in a way what they're being called, can do is, you know, kind of go through the process a little faster. How is that possible, and is that what you're doing? Are you finding that you're able to get the drugs through phase one and two in a way that when you're working for a big, more bureaucratic institution, you couldn't?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that a lot of what slows things down at big companies is process. Any change in plans needs to be vetted by committees. There's a lot of internal debate, and it just gets complicated. At Stromedics, I can basically raise my voice from my desk and everybody will hear me.
You like the nimbleness of the startup culture,
yeah,
essentially.
Yeah.
Scott, let me pull you in here. And Kurt, too. I mean, what is this telling us about sort of the state of the biotech and pharma industry here in Massachusetts? It seems on the surface to be quite an exciting development.
Yeah, I think the positive side of the development is that it's possible, you know, that you can be one person or six people and maybe find a promising new drug for Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's or pancreatic cancer, some disease that we just don't know how to treat, and maybe some of the bigger biotech and pharma companies aren't interested in or just aren't pursuing successfully. So it's great that it's possible and that these companies can be, you know, can be nimbler than maybe some of the big guys. I think the flip side is that what it's doing is it's, you know, they're almost like gold prospectors in, you know, in the 19th century. And, you know, you have the tools, you can do it. But I think once you find anything that's promising and shiny, you're probably going to hand it over to a big company for that, you know, for that exit that Kurt was talking about for the payout. And I think the result of that for Boston is that, you know, we might not get more big companies like Biogen's and Genzyme. I think you're going to get a lot of small companies prospecting around for cool new drugs that they then hand off to the big guys.
Kurt, is that a good thing for the industry here then, or not?
That's a great question, because it's almost like the way you had to be a big movie studio to make a movie. Now you can like form your own little company. You can buy a script. You can hire video editors to do that when you get to that point. You can create a movie, but then basically you're handing it off to the big movie studio, right, to do the distribution. So it's kind of a cool new thing that it's possible. I guess my question is just what does it say about the big companies and their failures that, you know, that sort of left this room in the market for these prospectors to come around? And in a way, it sort of points to the problem that, you know, big companies aren't doing drug development, you know, totally well, and that there's this room for other people to pick up the pieces.
Is this a natural outcome of what sounds like Kurt's describing, some kind of risk aversion in larger companies, Scott?
I don't know if it's so much risk aversion as just, you know, bigger companies tend to, you know, they spend a lot of their resources marketing and selling the products that they've already got approved through the FDA. And maybe a little bit less researching stuff that they don't in disease areas that they may not know about or may not have had success in the past. So, you know, it does create opportunities for these smaller companies. I think the reality, I liked Kurt's piece about the one person companies. I mean, I think the reality is really more, you know, what Boston does well is the 10, 20, 30 person company that really is just able to put more research. You know, you have more full time people in the lab and you're able to kind of get the ball further down the goal line than a one person company with all these contractors is going to be able to do.
Michael Gilman, is that your ultimate goal with the drugs that you're currently developing? It's to get them far enough such that then when it comes to those complicated phase three, you know, time and money intensive trials, that you'd have someone else take over from that point?
Yeah, I would say that's plan A, because I don't want to become a bureaucrat again. So and we're not really built or staffed. We don't have the right skill set to do that. I mean, that is a very different kind of company. And I think to come back to the other question you asked, you know, the drug that we're developing was actually born at Biogen and was developed at Biogen for several years, but was ultimately shelved in an annual portfolio review for a variety of reasons. It didn't fit with their strategy. They had, as Scott indicated, some budgetary constraints, and so they just shelved it. And we were able to get it, and of course we were able to put a very focused team to work on it, and we're able to solve some technical problems that they that they were struggling with, and hopefully we'll create something very valuable for our shareholders, ultimately for Biogen, since they have some financial interest in it, but most importantly for patients who, at the end of the day, I can assure you we're never going to see this drug if it had stayed there.
Well, we are talking about maybe a new way or a new way of thinking about drug development in the Massachusetts pharmaceutical and biotech industry. Smaller, more nimble companies getting the ball rolling and then maybe handing it off to larger companies. Does this sound like a good thing to you? Do you feel like maybe we might get more drugs or a bigger variety of drugs to market faster through this? Or does it sound like larger drug companies maybe just not being the leaders in the industry that they once were? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's take a call from Westboro. Robin is on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, Robin.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I was wondering whether having smaller companies would make it more likely that diseases or conditions that have fewer people affected would be able to get drugs that treat those conditions. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Robin, thanks for your call. Michael Gilman, let me start with you, and then I'd like to hear from Scott and Kurt as well.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's absolutely correct. But I would also point out that even the larger companies are getting very much more interested in these orphan diseases these days. So we see a lot of interest in the industry, big companies and small, in smaller diseases.
Scott?
Yeah, I can think of a, you know, half dozen companies right off the bat. Many of them have, that have gotten venture capital funding and are more of the 10 or 20 or 30 person company. But, you know, they're working on new approaches to treating autism or new approaches to treating these, you know, rare genetic diseases that thankfully, you know, 5,000, 10,000 people worldwide have. So I think, you know, the answer is, you know, a somewhat qualified yes, but mostly yes.
I would only add that you know, one criticism of big companies is that, at least recently, is that they've often been going after, I'm talking about, you know, drug giants, they've been going after sort of the Lipitor spin-off, the slight change to something that they can bring back on the market, maybe have a little improved efficacy, and then sort of keep selling for, you know, as long as they have the patent, while these other companies have often been going after, you know, really new things. Mm-hmm. And so it has made it maybe a more vibrant or diverse marketplace.
You know, a little earlier I mentioned this, the question of risk aversion, and that sort of also brings to mind to me another major issue here from an observer's perspective, and that is, you know, the other half of the risk-reward equation, which is the reward part. So if these smaller companies are doing all the legwork up front in getting a drug through phase one and phase two of the early stages of development, and for cheaper, as Kurt outlined, you know, the person that you spoke to was doing it for basically a tenth of the cost, or trying to. But on the other hand, then you got to hand it off to a big company at the end. So who gets the reward here? I mean, for the types of drugs, we're not going to see a Lipitor again tomorrow, per se, but we may eventually, when we're talking drugs that may ultimately generate millions upon millions, possibly billions of dollars, do the small companies, if they've sold it off to the Pfizers and the Mercks of the world, Michael Gilman, are you going to get the benefit for the work that you put in earlier?
Well, it kind of depends on whether the drug works or not, right? And that's the important point, is that the outcome for a company like us is completely binary, right? I mean, it'll either be zero or it'll be, you know, a pretty respectable number. I mean, companies like ours that get sold to drug companies will get sold for $100, $200 million. You know, that money gets split among all the investors. And, you know, our company is 80% owned by venture capitalists, so they'll walk away with the lion's share. But the employees of the company own the rest, and so they'll get that share. So a big company, a Pfizer, has now written a check. It's a check they could easily afford to write, but it's actually dwarfed by the amount of money they're probably going to spend over the next 5 to 7 years to complete the development program of that drug and get it out the door.
So they still are taking on quite a bit of risk.
Right,
then, even
and statistically, you know, there's still probably a 60 to 70% chance that drug is going to fail, but it's on them now. We've offloaded the risk.
Scott, I mean, what does this mean for the somewhat, I don't want to call them middle tier because they're not in terms of the types of work they do, but size? Because it seems like a lot of the companies that really are the nameplate companies in Massachusetts, the biotech world here, are sort of the middle-sized companies. They're not Pfizer, but they're also not, you know, a six-man crew. What does it mean for them, those in the middle?
I think it's going to be really hard to stay in the middle. We were actually, Michael and I were at a conference a couple weeks ago where the CEO of a company, Alnylam Pharmaceuticals in Cambridge, you know, classic mid-tier company, you know, they're publicly traded, maybe 80, 100 employees, haven't got a drug approved yet, but sort of have some promising candidates. And they were kind of saying, you know, we want to remain independent. We want to be in the middle, because if we were consumed by some big pharma company, we'd worry that they might shelve our drugs, or they might just mismanage it and it would never see the light of day. So, you know, in a way, they're like the, to go back to Kurt's filmmaker metaphor, you know, they're the Francis Ford Coppola type auteur who doesn't want someone else to screw up his movie. And, you know, he wants his vision to, you know, to wind up there on the screen. So I think we will still have some of those mid-tier companies. You know, the other one they were thinking about is Alkermes, you know, like roughly a 600-person company, publicly traded. You know, they make drugs for alcohol dependence. You will have them, but I think that middle area is going to be a hard place to survive. I think the model for the future maybe is these one-person companies, but also there was a company called Smart Cells that's working on a new kind of insulin. They had less than $10 million of investment, and Merck bought them for about $500 million when the company was just 2 or 3 years old. So that's kind of what I feel like Boston does well is, you know, you take this research idea out of academia, get a little bit of funding, prove it has promise, and then hand it over.
Kurt, you know, you were, well, actually, when you and I were talking about this over the course of the day, academia itself is also sort of one of the pressure points with for these middle-tier companies.
We're talking about sort of the top end, right, where these middle-tier companies sell to the big ones. But one thing to remember is that a lot of universities are doing a lot more work to try to take their drugs further or to take their discoveries to sort of a development-ready stage. So in a way, they're sort of carrying the baton, the drug development baton, a little bit further, taking some of the risk and some of the expense out for these mid-tier companies, handing it off there. And so that helps. They're sort of trying to claim a little more value out of, you know, the whole chain as well. And one other thing I'd say about the big companies is that, you know, there's a big question about these mid-sized biotech firms. But I think the same way that Sanofi of Venice has come into Boston, the same way we've seen so many other big drug firms bring presences here, I just think that we're going to be seeing more and more of that because there is this you know, there's this great landscape here in Boston, and so in a way, like the scale efficiencies of what used to be in a single company, they're also all of a sudden sort of being created in this cluster.
There's
here in
the
Boston.
The ecosystem, essentially.
Right, right.
Sanofi having purchased Genzyme
right.
recently.
For many of its orphan drugs. Right.
Well, we are talking about maybe sort of an emerging trend in biotech and pharma here in Massachusetts, and that is small virtual companies doing a lot of the essential early legwork in drug development. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. James is calling from Medford. Welcome to Radio Boston, James.
Oh, hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome. What's your thought today?
Well, so I lead a virtual biotechnology company. We started in 2006, and we have investors from you know, a variety of pharmaceutical companies. And just to the earlier point of how much can you do with one or two people, we essentially found technology at Harvard, and you know, with no more than two people at any one point in time, have taken it through the point where we're going to the FDA this fall for a new application, new treatment in the area of rheumatoid arthritis. So with the skills that are out there today, both in contractors and consultants, it's really quite extraordinary what you can do with just one person.
James, if I may ask, how much of capital has gone into getting the drug to the, well, I guess all the way to the FDA?
Well, we're funded all the way through our early stage clinical development, and including that money, it'll be about $15 million. So that's from discovery all the way through to phase two clinical studies.
And you were, it seems like, was it easy for you to secure that investment?
You know, it was surprisingly easy. You know, it was some very exciting research out of Harvard. And you know, the story behind the science is very important in terms of raising that money. And we've been very successful in terms of taking it through from you know, the bench research at Harvard through to demonstrating that this should be tested in man.
James, thank you so much for your call. Michael Gilman, you're a founder and CEO of Strometics. I mean, money, we can't escape the question of money here. James says he was able to get the $15 million pretty easily. Are there a lot of venture capitalists who are interested in these small, nimble firms?
Yeah, oh yeah, there's money out there. We've raised about $30 million. I mean, it's an ordeal to get it. But it's out there, and I think there's a great deal of interest now in the venture capital community in these sorts of smaller virtual companies because of the capital efficiency. Because at the end of the day, the investors make their money when the company is sold. These companies tend to be sold for sort of a narrow band, and so it's the denominator that determines what the return on their investment is. So they try and keep that money spent low.
Scott Kersner and Kurt Nikisch here. We can't. Nobody is writing the big companies out of the picture here, obviously. The pharmaceutical and biotech world is much too complicated, and to say that, you know, the Pfizer and Sanofi aren't going to be players here. And in fact, if I understand correctly, they, in a way, are sort of mimicking these small more nimble companies by expanding their footprint in the greater Boston area in a unique way. Scott, can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, they're trying all kinds of different models that don't involve, you know, $100,000 a year chemist or biologist sitting in a lab developing drugs in their own building. So, you know, they're trying corporate venture capital. You know, let's put money into Michael's company or James's company and see if it pans out. You know, $1 million or $2 million may be a worthy investment. They're collaborating with venture capital firms to kind of try to do these prototype. Let's prove that there's some value in this idea before we pre-fund it further. And, you know, they're trying to start smaller labs that maybe, 100 people, you know, a group that's kind of like almost like a SWAT team focused on a particular disease area, but isn't kind of constrained by being part of a giant research organization.
Yeah. You know, and Kurt, before you answer, I want to throw out one last question as well after you answer, but I got to get it out of there before I forget. If we're seeing capital efficiencies and development costing, you know, a fraction of what it used to, is that going to be then translated to me, the drug, you know, user at the end of the day? Can drugs be made cheaper for insurance companies and those of us who take them? So I want to put that out there. But Kurt, go ahead.
I'll start with the first question. and it's interesting that this whole trend actually sort of started at Eli Lilly, because there was this big company that decided it wanted to try sort of internally a whole new model and set these people off to their side with their own funding, and they started spinning out some of their stuff. And I think some of their graduates, so to speak, went on to Abbott Research Labs and some other places in Massachusetts. So it's I think that's the one thing that this one-person drug company phenomenon, which is sort of the extreme example of virtual companies, shows, is that, like, you know, the credit markets are changing, development research is changing, so they're just trying to find different ways to bring stuff to market. I don't know how long they're going to be around or how it's going to play out. It's a really exciting, dynamic time in the biotech sector in Boston right now.
So, Michael Gilman, I'm going to put that last question to you. Do you think that the efficiencies can then be transferred to the price point at the end of the day?
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, drugs are expensive because they're expensive to develop. And if we can reduce the cost of development, then I think it should get cheaper at the other end.
Well, that is Michael Gilman, founder and CEO of Strometics. It's a venture-backed biotech company based in Cambridge. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And Scott Kersner, innovation columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to have you.
Thanks.
And Kurt Nikisch, WBUR's business and technology reporter. Thank you so much for reporting on this.
You're welcome.